Let's turn to Genesis 19 again. We're looking at the delivery of Lot and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah this morning in Genesis chapter 19. Just by way of review, what we talked about last hour is, you'll remember now that judgment has been announced on Sodom and Gomorrah. God already told Abraham that he will destroy the cities, and a point has been established. And that was Abraham's conversation with God. And that point is simply that God's righteous judgment will not allow him to judge a just man along with the wicked. And remember, in chapter 18, Abraham and God dickered around for a while. He started with 50. He said, if there were 50 righteous men in Sodom, you wouldn't destroy the city, would you? And God said, no, of course not. And then he went down to 40, 30, 20, and he ended with 10. And that's in verse 32, where it says, then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. And that's where they left off. But as we noticed last hour, there weren't even 10 people there that were righteous. So the point is, God will not destroy the righteous with the unrighteous. Not any of them. In fact, the four that are there, he's going to send the angels to come and get out of the city before it's destroyed. We noted that the state of Sodom in verse 1 and 2 was that, or the state of Lot in Sodom, how he related to the city was that he was sitting in the gate of Sodom. And we noted last time that the gate of a city represented where all the business was transacted. It was kind of like a courthouse. It's where all the records were made. The scribes were positioned there. And it was kind of where they did all the official business of the town. So Lot was then, we can assume, thoroughly involved in the city of Sodom. He was thoroughly involved in the politics of the city, or the affairs of the city anyway. And he was quite involved there. Now, Sodom itself, in verses 3 through 8, we discovered, was totally permeated with sin. We noted that when the men came, when the Sodomites came to Lot's house, in verse 4 it says, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, and that's Lot's house, where the two angels were staying, remember, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. So all of these men wanted to come and have homosexual relationships with Lot's visitors, who he was had under his roof and under his protection. And we noted that Lot, his condition, he had high standards, but his witness was a joke. He had high standards. He was tortured every day. We saw that up in 2 Peter last hour, that Lot was tortured because inside he was a righteous man, and he saw he was surrounded by sinfulness, just absolutely surrounded by it down in Sodom. And it ended up that his witness became a joke because he was so involved in the city. We noted last hour, here was Lot, who was tortured day after day after day by all this sin, and yet he wouldn't move. All he had to do was move. Abraham lived out in the desert in tents, and he was blessed. So his witness was a joke. In verse 14, it says, when Lot went out to speak to his son-in-laws, at the end of the verse, he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. So they took his witness that the city was to be destroyed as a joke. They thought, oh, he's just kidding. His senses were dulled to the word of God. In verse 15, it says, when morning dawned and the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he hesitated. Boy, talk about being dulled to the word of God. He knew these angels could perform what they said they were going to, because they had performed a supernatural act before. They struck everybody blind. So Lot knew these guys had the power to do what they were saying, and they said, you better get out of here because we're going to destroy this city. And they were on a timetable, and we'll look at that in a moment. And he hesitated. Wait a minute. Can't we talk this over? I got a nice house here. You know, and I spent a lot of years trying to get my lawn just right, and now it's perfect, and you're telling me I got to leave? He was so attached to what he had there that his senses were dulled to the word. He had a perverted attachment to the city. When they said in verse 17, when they brought him outside, one said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains or you will be swept away. But Lot said to them, oh no, my lords, don't destroy the city. You know, it's my home. So he had a perverted attachment to this city, which was just a pile of bricks. He had dulled perspective. In verse 19, it says, now behold, your servant has favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown by saving my life. But, whoa, he had a condition he wanted to put on this. Now that's what Carl Dendy likes to call a Christian but. He always has a but, you know. And Lot's the same way. He has a dulled perspective because God has saved him, and he now wants to put conditions on. Wait a minute, but his perspective is dulled. And again, day by day, he was tortured by the surroundings that he had to live in, and yet he wouldn't move. He was too comfortable there. And we all know about that, don't we? We get comfortable. We're not creatures that like to change a lot. We like to have things stay the way they are. And change comes difficult to us. But that's the way Lot was. That's certainly the way I am. I get upset when anything changes. If I have to take my car in to get it oil changed, it upsets my whole schedule for the week. I don't like change. I like things to stay the same way. Moving wouldn't help that, though. I'd still have to take my car in. So let's look at, and let's continue on now. That's kind of where we left off last time. We were looking at Lot's condition, and now we're going to look at his rescue and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. We're looking at verses 1 through 23 altogether. We ended over in verse 12 last time. And the announcement of the angels is given in verse 12 through 14. Let's read those. Verse 12 says, then the two men said to Lot, whom else have you here? A son-in-law and your sons and your daughters and whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, and said, up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. So that's the announcement. Now, by this time, Lot knows that the angels are legitimate, because in verse 10 and 11, they performed a miracle. Look, verse 10, it says, but the men reached out their hands, and the men are his guests, the angels. The men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. So all these guys, these Sodomites, were outside of Lot's house, and they wanted to come in and get the two guests that Lot had, and they wanted to take them out and have homosexual relationships with them. That, there's no other way to put that. That's what they wanted to do. So the angels drug Lot back inside, shut the door, and struck everybody blind outside. Lot knows these guys are legitimate angels now. They performed a miracle. He knows they have the power to back up what they're saying. Remember, we call that talionic justice, where the people were struck blind physically because they were blind morally. So the justice kind of fits the crime that it goes with. We see that a lot in the Bible. They were struck with physical blindness because of their moral blindness. But the message is perfectly clear, and that is, whoever wants to escape judgment has to leave the city. You can't just duck and cover. Anybody remember the duck and cover public service announcements back in the 1950s and 60s? And a lot of you don't, I see that. They used to say, if you see a nuclear bomb, duck and cover. Yeah. They even had a little jingle. You don't remember that? Duck and cover. They teach it in the schools like it would do any good. I mean, they just did it to make people feel better, like you can do something if a nuclear bomb hits. But anyway, these guys' message was perfectly clear. If you want to escape, you can't duck and cover. You have to leave the entire city. That's the only way that you're going to escape that. God, of course, is a gracious God. So what does he say to Lot? He said he could take anybody he wanted to. He says, we are about to destroy this place. Oh, up above in verse 12, the two men said to Lot, whom else have you here? A son-in-law and your sons and your daughters and whomever you want, whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place. Anybody you want to. So God is a gracious God. He says, Lot, you can save anyone you want, and I'll spare them. So whoever wants to escape judgment has to leave the city. God says he'll take them and anybody else who wants to come along. But the message is perfectly clear. The city is about to be destroyed. There's no question now. And Lot and his family knows that. And Lot reacts accordingly. At first, he immediately goes out to find his daughters and their husbands to give them the warning. And in verse 11, it says, they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness. So apparently they had left now. Being struck blind would kind of put you off your original purpose. And so they had left. And he goes out and finds his sons-in-laws, but his witness is not taken seriously. In fact, his witness is ridiculed. In verse 14, at the end of the verse, it says, but he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. So they thought it was all a joke. Here's Lot. He tells us the city's going to be destroyed. Yeah, right. So they didn't pay any attention to him. Now, interesting thing here in the text, notice up in verse 12, where it says, then the two men said to Lot, whom else have you here? A son-in-law, your sons and your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place. It kind of implies there he had sons, didn't it? But it doesn't say anything about him going to tell his sons or warn them. Now, there's two ways you can take this. You can take this that he didn't have sons. But I think the angels would have known that. Because they told him, they reminded him to go out and talk to his sons-in-law. And they said, talk to your sons too. But the text doesn't ever say he did. It's just kind of interesting. Now, does that mean that he knew that his sons were so involved in the wickedness of Sodom that it wasn't even worthwhile to go to them? That would be a terrible example of what a father's witness or a father's compromise could do to his children. You know, if a father compromises and gets along with the city like Lot did, remember, he was down at the gate. He was one of the people who were the movers and shakers of the city. He was thoroughly involved. Does this mean his sons became so involved that he knew they wouldn't even make a dent in him? I don't know. It's hard to say. He may have not had sons, but it seems verse 12 seems to imply that he did. And we notice that when he leaves, he doesn't have any sons with him, just his wife and his two daughters, his two unmarried daughters. Just something to think about. Fathers, something to think about. If you compromise so much with the system, it's going to have an effect on your children. It just will. Now the escape in verse 15 through 23. Verse 15 says, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. And they brought him out and put him outside the city. When they had brought them outside, one said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains or you will be swept away. But Lot said, oh, no, my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown to me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, for disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please, let me escape there. Is it not small, that my life may be saved? He said to them, behold, I grant this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore, the name of that town was called Zoar. And the sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. Okay, so they escape. Lot apparently still had some influence on his wife and his unmarried daughters because they came with him. But if you stop and think about it, you know, his wife and his unmarried daughters were there with him. So they would have seen what the angels did firsthand. So it may not have been Lot's witness totally that got them to leave, but they were eyewitnesses to the supernatural powers of these two guests that they had. So they went with Lot when the angels urged them the next morning. In verse 15, it says, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city. And they went with him. Now, even so, they all hesitated. They held back. Why did they hold back? They didn't want to leave their comfortable surroundings. It was comfortable. Even though sin was surrounding them everywhere, they had their little house and they were comfortable in it, and they held back. Verse 16, but he hesitated. He didn't want to leave. So that ends up the angels have to drag them out of town. And put yourself in that place, you know. You know these guys are what they claim to be because they just performed a miracle. They just struck all the men blind. And then they say, we're going to destroy this city. And the only way to escape that destruction is to leave the city entirely. So let's go. Wait a minute. I don't think that'd be my reaction. Maybe, I don't know. I'm a sinner just like Lot was, but I think I would have been outside the city telling the angels, come on, catch up, guys. We got to get out of here. So Lot, he comes up with a compromise. I mean, this is so cheeky, it almost blows me away, you know. In verse 19 and 20, verse 19, it says, now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight. So he recognizes that God is displaying his grace, and it says, you have magnified your loving kindness, which is another word for God's grace, which you have shown me by saving my life. But, and there's that Christian but, he has a condition. I cannot escape to the mountains, for disaster will overtake me, and I will die. So instead of just being content with his life being saved, that's not enough. He begs the angels to let him move into one of the surrounding cities, one called Zoar, and says, would you please spare that city, and I'll move over there so I don't have to go up in the mountains. You know, it's not very comfy up in the mountains. I'm an urbanite. I don't dwell in the mountains very well. So Lot, can you imagine the cheek of this guy? God saved his life, and he says, well, yeah, but, you know, those mountains, I don't like mountains. I want to live in a city. So can I move to this little city, and you please not destroy it? Now, presumably, Zoar was the smallest of the cities on the plain there, or the valley, and the one that was least infected with wickedness. So Lot pleads that he would not be able to survive in the mountains. Now think about that one. Lot is a perfect example of almost every Christian I've ever known, myself included. He just trusted God for the big thing, to save his life. And now he won't trust him for his daily needs. He says, I won't survive in the mountains. Hey, God just came and rescued you from the destruction of a whole city. You think he can't provide you for you in the mountains? But Lot didn't, you know, he didn't connect these two. And most of us don't either. You know, we trust God for the big thing, our eternal destiny. You know, as a believer, we place our eternal destiny in the hands of another person. I say, God, I know that I cannot do anything to save myself. I'm completely helpless. So I'm putting everything in your hands. That's a big step, isn't it? And most of us are very uncomfortable with that because we want to have something to do with our salvation. We want to say, well, you know, I at least had something to do with it. I got baptized, so that must be the reason. I mean, that's like, I like to use the expression or the illustration of a guy, somebody comes up to you and says, you know what, I'm going to give you free of charge a brand new Rolls Royce Camargue. Brand new, no strings attached, free. And you say to that guy, oh, here, can I pay a dollar for that at least? You see, would you be insulted if somebody said that to you? If you were the giver? Well, that's the way it is with God. I mean, that's the way we respond, you know, sometimes. Oh, God, you give me this wonderful salvation. Can't I at least pay you something for it? That's spitting in God's face. Because he offers this salvation free of charge. And if he can save me, if I turn my eternal destiny over to him, then I can turn my daily life over to him. And that's what Lot didn't want to do. So he pleads with the angels not to have to go to those uncomfortable mountains, because I want to dwell in the city. That's almost pitiful, isn't it, the way he pleads with these guys. He wants to retain at least some comfort in his world. Now, the word Zoar means small place, and that's why it says in verse 22, therefore the name of the town was called Zoar, because it means small place. And he said, there's this little city. It was close by. It wouldn't be a hard journey. I wouldn't have to climb. You know, I'm getting old. I don't want to climb. I have to climb these mountains. Can't I just move to a nearby city and you don't destroy that nearby city? Lot was a righteous man. And we saw that in 2 Peter. And the sin that he saw tormented him, but his carnality keeps popping up at every turn, doesn't it? He doesn't want to leave. He doesn't. And then when he does leave, he doesn't want to go to the mountains. He doesn't want to trust God. And yet God makes him trust him at each step in the way. And here, unbelievable. Do we have a gracious God or what? He says, okay, Lot, I'll let you go and live in that other city. I mean, after he had just saved him from total annihilation, and Lot comes back, let's make a deal, and God says, okay, I'll grant you that wish. You can go live in Zoar. Boy, talk about a gracious God and a long-suffering God. Can you imagine? God, geez, he just keeps coming up with one thing after another. But okay, I'll let you go. You go live in that city. So now we come then to the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. We got Lot taken care of now. He's finally come to an agreement, a compromise with God that he can live with. So God destroys the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the time of the judgment is just after dawn. And I mentioned before that the timing is important in this destruction. And that's why the angels were so anxious to get Lot and his family out of town, because the timing was important. It was just after dawn. In verse 15, it says, when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city. So just after dawn, at dawn they told Lot, get up, get out of town. We're on a schedule here. You'll be destroyed. Why did they have that schedule? Well, if it was just after dawn, the city would be awake. People would be up eating their breakfasts, you know, getting ready for work, doing what people do in the morning. But normally, by and large, the people would be awake and they would know what was coming, God's judgment. And it was before any of the inhabitants would be leaving, and apparently a lot of them were farmers, so, you know, they lived in a valley that was rich. Remember, that's why Lot went there in the first place when he split up with Abraham. And so it would be before the farmers went out to work their fields. Now, if you talk to a farmer, I have a father-in-law who's a farmer. If you talk to them, they're out working their fields 24/7. You know, you can't get up before them. It's impossible. So, you know, they'd still be up. They'd be getting their breakfast, going about their business. And before any travelers would be getting into town. You know, they didn't travel much at night back then. It was kind of dangerous. So here they'd be, the city would be awake and aware of God's judgment coming upon them. They wouldn't have had a chance to get out to go to work to escape the judgment, nor would anybody who wasn't a city dweller have time to get there and receive judgment he didn't deserve. So the timing was important. The nature of the destruction is brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. Now, this statement can be taken two ways, and I'm going to let you decide which way you want to take it. I'll tell you how I take it. It can be interpreted as providential or supernatural. Now, why do I say that? Well, the valley that these cities sat in is above a big fault line. And that fault line goes all the way from the Dead Sea down to southern Africa. All the way down there, a big fault line. It's called the Great Fault. That whole area where Sodom and Gomorrah were located, and we don't know exactly where. I know, you look on the internet and you say, Sodom discovered, Gomorrah discovered, and all this and that. But we don't know exactly where they were. A lot of people think they're at the bottom of the Dead Sea, which is a pretty good guess as far as that goes, but they'd be at the southern end of the Dead Sea anyway. And that whole area around there, it's amazing because it's made of combustible materials. There's organic materials that have become oil, and there is asphalt, natural gas, and there's a lot of free sulfur there too. So the whole place is kind of like a powder keg down there. Look at Genesis 14, in fact. We see it biblically and we see it historically. In Genesis 14 and verse 10, we're talking about the Valley of Siddim. It says, "Now the Valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. But those who survived fled to the hill country." So if you fled Sodom and Gomorrah, you're likely to fall into a tar pit. So very combustible nature of the area around there. And in fact, the Jewish historian Josephus spoke of the Dead Sea. He called it the Asphalt Sea because it has a lot of asphalt in the material. So God could have destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah providentially. And what I mean by providentially is I mean God just uses natural phenomenon to carry out his justice, providence. So he could have triggered an earthquake along that great fault line, and the fire and brimstone could be referenced to the vast quantities of burning gas and sulfur that would have been thrown into the air and fell back to the earth. Now that's a possible explanation. The material could have been ignited by lightning, a concurrent electrical storm. So it's very plausible that God could have used providential means. Or God could have sent a divinely created fire supernaturally to destroy the cities. You can take that either way, and I won't argue with you. I take it to be a supernatural destruction. In fact, the word sulfur in the New Testament is an interesting word. It's the word theon, and it literally means God's fire. God's fire. So I think probably you can take it either way. I take it to be supernatural rather than providential. But it could well have been providential. In verse 26, we have the strange incident of Lot's wife. I wanted to call it the curious incident of Lot's wife, because that goes with a Sherlock Holmes story, the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. Remember that? But the dog did nothing in the nighttime. That was the curious incident. I love Sherlock Holmes. You guys know that. Anyway, the strange incident or the curious incident of Lot's wife in verse 26. It says, "But his wife from behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt." If you go to that region, you'll find that there are many pillars of salt there. That's a very common thing. And most of them, at one time or another, by the have been called Lot's wife by the Arabs because she was turned into a pillar of salt there. But again, I'm going to leave you to your own devices. I'll tell you what I think, but I'll leave you to your own devices, is that her turning into a pillar of salt, it could have been sudden and miraculous. All things are possible with God, right? Could he turn somebody into a pillar of salt? Sure he could. Wouldn't even cause him to break a sweat. He could do that easily. Or it could have been the natural outcome of her reluctance to leave Sodom. And I think that's the real explanation. Why was she turned into a pillar of salt? Because she didn't want to leave. Well, how could that be a natural outcome? Look up at Luke 17. In In Luke 17, we have a reference to this that gives us some information. In verse 32 and 33, it says, "Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to keep his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it." So this is, and he's using the Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt as an illustration of this. And what's he talking about? Well, the implication is that Lot's wife was trying to hang on to her life back in Sodom. She didn't want to leave the comfort. So she lagged behind. And picture them leaving the city and it's being destroyed, and his wife is lagging behind, looking back. It says she looked back, and the word looked back, it's the word navat in Hebrew, has the connotation of looking intently, not just a glance back. And sometimes you see it in the movies, you know, she glances back and then turns into a pillar of salt. That's not what that word means at all. It means to look intently at something. Or figuratively, according to Brown, Driver, and Briggs's lexicon, their Hebrew lexicon, it means regard or show regard to, pay attention to. So the idea is that she looked longingly back and she lagged behind, looking back, missing her comfortable home, and got zapped along with the destruction. And I think that's the answer, because that's a lesson for us. There's a lesson for us in there, that she longed for that city life so much that she lagged behind everybody else and turned around and was looking longingly back. She may have even started to return. She just couldn't take it, because notice it says she was behind them. But in any case, she was not with her husband and daughters. So only she perished. Turned into a pillar of salt, and what does that mean? Well, it could be just a supernatural zot turned into a pillar of salt. Or it could mean that she was covered by the salt that the explosions threw into the air. You know, the whole place is just full of salinity. In fact, you know, the Dead Sea is an interesting place, because it's fed by a river and it doesn't have any exit. I mean, there's no place for the water to go. It comes in, but it never goes out. It only evaporates. And when it evaporates, what happens? The salinity keeps getting higher and higher, because evaporation causes it to, the surface tension, I think. Bert, is that correct? The surface tension would cause the water to absorb the salts, and when it evaporates, the water's salinity rises and rises. That's why the Dead Sea is so salty. You ever wonder why you could go over there and you can't sink yourself, they say? I've never been there, but that's what they say. But it has no outlets whatsoever. So there's great quantities of salt in that region that would produce this salinity. And if a great explosion occurred, it would come up and come down. It could have buried her, because she wouldn't follow along fast enough. Or she could have been buried in volcanic ash and turned to salt slowly over the ages, like the people buried under Mount Vesuvius. Similar to that. So either one of those explanations would explain why, when she lagged behind, she was turned into a pillar of salt. Or it could have been supernatural. Again, I'll leave it to you to decide. I prefer the explanation that she lagged behind and she paid the price for it, and she got zapped. But the lesson of Lot's wife, either way you take it, the lesson of Lot's wife is pretty simple, isn't it? If believers get caught up in the things of the world, they can get burned by them. That was true then, it's true now. Now, she left with Lot, but she didn't want to leave that comfort. You know, sometimes we become believers, we don't want to leave the comfort of our old situations because people are going to make fun of us now. They're going to say, oh, man, you know, you become a Bible thumper. You're one of those crazy Christians now. So you start compromising and you start, well, you know, it's more comfortable just to not say anything about being a believer, not to witness at all because, you know, if I do that, people are going to laugh at me. And you know what? If you get too comfortable, you might get burned. It happened to Lot's wife. It can happen to us. And then just finishing out in verse 27 through 29, we get Abraham's view, where it says, "Now Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Thus it came about, when God destroyed the cities of the valley, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived." Father, thank you again for your word, and thank you again for the lessons that you teach us on every page of the Bible, from the Old Testament to the New, from Genesis to Revelation. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.